From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. For all the danger of PFAS in drinking water, attention's turning to airborne exposures.
We've got something that is in danger of becoming sort of the DDT of our era.
Congressman Andy Levin joins us. Also on the show, Michigan classrooms increasingly rely on long-term substitute teachers. A new survey challenges the state to do better.
We found broad consensus that people have less confidence in long-term uncertified substitutes, and they would be concerned or very concerned if their student had a long-term sub in their classroom all year.
We'll get reaction from auto and ag industries on the recently approved trade deal. And one dumb Buckeye looks for ways to address her fellow Michiganders? Michiganians? Listen, somebody better help me with this or I'm going to get in real trouble. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan communities have been consumed with concerns over PFAS contamination in our lakes, rivers, and groundwater. But what is the risk posed by PFAS in the air? Later on today, Congressman Andy Levin joins us to talk about potential new regulations for safe disposal of so-called forever chemicals. But first, the U.S. Senate has overwhelmingly approved a new North American Free Trade Agreement. It rewrites the rules of trade with Canada and Mexico, replacing the 25-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement known as NAFTA, which tore down trade barriers. Critics blamed NAFTA for encouraging U.S. companies to move their manufacturing plants south of the border, taking advantage of low-wage labor and less regulation. And there's been no small amount of talk about how this new deal, the USMCA, will affect the domestic auto industry. Kristen Gicek is Vice President for Industry, Labor, and Economics at the Center for Automotive Research. Kristen, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
Do you think the deal as it stands right now is a win for the Big Three?
Well, you know, a win for the Big Three and for all of the automotive industry in Michigan and in the United States is to continue to have free trade in North America. I mean, the supply chains that have been built up since NAFTA was first instituted mean that we're really making vehicles together. We're not just trading with each other. And, you know, the threat that that might have gone away was significant, and I think, you know, you couldn't discount it. I think the big win is that there continues to be that free flow of automotive goods across this region.
Right. Cars and trucks are put together in pieces these days. You're saying this deal delivers the seamless zero tariff border crossings that the automakers need to keep the assembly
yes.
process moving from one country to the next?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we're looking at digesting all of the things that happened in the UAW negotiations this last fall.
Right.
And looking at what our forecasts are for automotive production, it looks like U.S. automotive production is going to increase modestly, not just for the Detroit 3 automakers, but for all automakers. And that may have been a response to the risks they were facing about potentially having their production on the wrong side of the border in a trade conflict within North America. So, you know, most of the automakers are going to show an increase in U.S. production.
Part of this deal requires that at least 30% of the work on a car or truck to be done by workers earning $16 an hour. That's, again, aimed at lower wage workers in Mexico. It's still lower go ahead.
It's 40% of cars, 45% of trucks have to be made at the labor value content rule. There are credits within that for where it's assembled and for doing research and development or IT work in the country. There's a number of labor reforms aimed at Mexico. Mexico had to pass labor law reforms before they could even move forward to the stage that they're at now. But I don't think very many folks think that this is going to raise the wage in Mexico to $16 an hour. What it's going to do is make sure a certain percentage of the vehicle is made in a high-wage region like the United States or Canada.
It does seem there's an awful lot in this agreement from Mexico to comply with, some of it outside of the auto industry. The Mexican government will have to allow some things to make union representation easier. Do you think it's realistic that Mexico is going to be able to implement all this in a timely way?
Well, they did pass the labor law reforms about making unionization easier. And then there were some last-minute dealings just before the House passed the USMCA that put in place some monitoring and making sure that that Mexico is complying with those changes that were necessitated and that were required to move the deal forward. So, you know, the AFL-CIO, the powerful coalition of unions, did endorse the USMCA, but only after they extracted some of those labor law changes in Mexico and the enforcement mechanism for that.
Do you think that the provisions that are in this agreement will hold up as the industry moves toward electrification in most of its models?
I think, that's a very interesting question. And one thing is, when the president looked to renew or renegotiate NAFTA, that was one of the big criticisms, is that NAFTA based content on a set list of parts. And there were parts on that list that were no longer in vehicles. 8-track tape players is the one that Secretary Ross used to mention, and distributor caps and things like that. It was a set list, and it hadn't changed in many, many years. This new paradigm for how we count content is much more flexible to modernization of the content. So there's a broader swath of vehicle content that will be counted as originating in North America. Before, if it wasn't on that list, they just said, oh, well, it must have been made in North America. It was called deemed originating. And there was a lot of stuff on that list that wasn't originating in North America. So, I think this is a much more flexible and modern approach to those changes in vehicles. But on electrification, many of the electric vehicles produced in the U.S. Have some of the lower U.S. and Canadian content. That's the only publicly available data set we have.
Kristen, I'm sorry, we do have to wrap this up. We'd like to come back to this issue later in the year. Kristen Gichek from the Center for Automotive Research. Kind of a huge day for trade deals. Also today, President Trump signed an agreement with China. The Phase One trade agreement is expected to reduce tensions in a trade dispute that has slowed global growth, hurt American manufacturers, and weighed down the Chinese economy as well. Among other things, the agreement calls for China to purchase $200 billion worth of U.S. goods and services over the next 2 years, a good amount of which will be in agricultural products. Jim Byram is president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association, and he joins us now. Jim, good to have you.
Pleasure to be with you.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue calls this deal great news for American farmers and ranchers. Do you agree?
Oh, I think it's great news. There's no question that signing an agreement with China is positive. I mean, it's a positive move, and frankly, some of the challenges we've had over the past several months, this is certainly great news that we're moving forward and back to status quo, if you will.
For all the agreement was reached, tariffs remain in place. Do you foresee that being much of a problem for Michigan crops?
Well, it's going to be interesting how the tariffs are imposed or how the tariffs are handled. Certainly, the Chinese end they need certain things. They need a lot of pork. They need probably fewer soybeans they've had in the past or purchased in the past. But they'll be buying some agricultural products. So they've introduced and actually imposed some waivers to allow some products to move that direction. In terms of products coming here, my sense is that there will be a softening overall on both ends of the trade spectrum, and I think that's great if we can move that direction and keep that momentum to try to bring trade back to normal.
This deal will be in place for only the next 2 years. Do you think that truly delivers the stability that was promised or that farmers had hoped for?
I've been doing this a long, long time, and the one thing we like to have is fair, free, consistent, reliable, predictable trade. A two-year agreement said it's no agreement, but 2 years is not very long, and it can go by pretty fast.
Right. Do China's commitments, that $200 billion that we heard about, does that go beyond what might have already fallen away during the course of the trade dispute?
Well, in theory, it's more. In theory, our trade would increase. I mean, the challenge is how that's measured, are there penalties in place if those numbers aren't achieved. There's an awful lot of skepticism in agriculture about how if they can hit the numbers they're talking about, just our ag trade. There are some things that folks are talking about, maybe just bookkeeping issues that might be able to help the Chinese meet that goal. But, you know, there's a healthy amount of skepticism about the Chinese actually achieving what may be agreed here.
What does this mean in terms of Michigan farmers' markets overseas in China? How much did they lose during the trade war? Do you think this deal is going to help them get those customers back?
Two things are important. First, in terms of farmer income, the U.S. government paid farmers a lot of money in the last 18 months, 2 years, when those trade deals were thrown in the trash, or the agreements in the trash, and the tariffs imposed. So the federal government has paid farmers a lot of money, so their farm income wasn't hurt as badly as it could have been. In terms of lost markets, once you lose a market, it doesn't come running back. It could be very difficult to create, again, that stability and reliability as a supplier. Chinese want elsewhere to buy. We're going to have to earn those markets back. An agreement is great. It's a step. It's a step forward. But it'll take a while before there's a comfort on both sides of the Pacific on that whole trade agreement, trade range, if you will.
Jim, critics have some concerns that maybe this agreement doesn't do much to force China to make the economic changes that the Trump administration was looking for in the first place in trying to get the Chinese to the table. Do you agree?
You know, I haven't really looked at the political ramifications of what the trade agreement does on achieving some of President Trump's goals, but I'm a pretty simple kind of operation here. Our industry is we just want to have fair, free, and open trade, and we need to be moving stuff abroad. We have way too many soybeans, way too much commodity and inventory, and we have to export. So just having the opportunity to see stuff move forward for the Chinese is a huge win. Certainly, if goals are not met, I'm confident that folks will be holding the Chinese feet to the fire.
Well, thanks very much for checking in with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
That's Jim Byram, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. I'm guessing we were getting him at the local grain elevator. Stay with us. Coming up, more students in the state are in classrooms with long-term substitute teachers instead of certified teachers. And a new survey finds that a large majority of Michigan residents think that that's a problem. We'll discuss what parents and educators think about the issue and what some potential solutions might look like. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Kids in Michigan schools are spending more and more time with substitute teachers. Last year, Bridge Magazine reported that subs were leading thousands of classrooms on a long-term basis. Many of them are not certified and unqualified for the subjects they teach. Alexandra Schmidt is public engagement director and a reporter at Bridge Magazine. Alexandra, welcome back to Stateside.
Great to be here again.
So the stage that we're at now is post-survey, post-summit. Do you feel like there was consensus about long-term reliance on substitutes being a crucial problem?
Yes. We asked residents what their confidence level were in full-time teachers that are certified and long-term uncertified subs, as well as their concern level if they had a student who had a long-term sub. And we found broad consensus that people have less confidence in long-term uncertified substitutes, and they would be concerned or very concerned if their student had a long-term sub in their classroom all year.
I don't know if this was an explicit question, but did respondents say it was more important than the shortage of qualified teachers? That is, after all, why the stopgap method of long-term subs are being used.
Yes. So that is really something we heard from education experts a bit more than from residents. Experts said that teacher shortage is really what is driving it, and that if we don't solve the teacher shortage, that it's going to be more difficult to solve the issue of long-term subs in Michigan classrooms. We did ask Michigan residents about four different options to increase the number of certified teachers in Michigan classrooms, and we found a really high support for all four of those options. One of those was offering financial incentives for teachers to work in understaffed schools. One was expanding the state's interim teaching certificate program, encouraging undergraduates to enroll in teacher preparation programs, and reforming state law so retired teachers can substitute without diminished retirement benefits. And we found that over 90% of residents supported all of those options.
I was going over the results, and there's a ton of information there about what people would support. But could you talk to us a little bit about specifically how subs are turned into qualified subs, are turned into certified teachers? I mean, a lot of people have concerns about what long-term subs mean in terms, you know, what does that to mean the hard work and the very hard-won knowledge that a certified, trained professional teaching corps brings to the job? But what about the barriers in terms of why the subs aren't becoming and progressing forward into full-time positions?
Mm-hmm. So right now, to be hired as a long-term substitute teacher, you need to have 60 educational credits past high school. So that equates to about 2 years of a bachelor's degree or an associate's degree. Those credits can be in any topic. It doesn't have to be related to education or the topic that you're hired to teach. Certified teachers have to go through a bachelor's program, student teaching. There are a lot more qualifications that you need to go through. There is a program that the state has called an interim teaching certificate program that allows people with a bachelor's degree and relevant work experience to get their teaching certification in 1 year. That was actually expanding that program was the most popular solution offered when we polled Michigan residents. That is a program that some schools relying on long-term subs use as a professional development tool, but it's not something that every long-term sub in the state wants to do.
Let's talk a little bit more about what the survey and the forums turned up about the salaries that teachers are paid. One of the recommendations is that, you know, just increasing the salary for teachers is mission critical. I mean, is that something that realistically can be acted on sooner rather than later?
Yeah, so the education experts that we spoke with said that low salaries are definitely a deterrent to people entering and staying in the profession, and the residents across the state supported financial incentives for teachers to go to understaffed schools, but certainly working out how to pay for that is always going to be the issue that the legislature would need to work through if they wanted to move forward on that.
I assume you were in the room for a lot of these sessions.
So I was there for the conference that we hosted in Lansing last November.
What did you notice about people's frustrations with the situation?
One of the really common things that we have heard at public engagement meetings across the state over the last several years of doing public engagement campaigns like this is a lot of frustration from educators at what they perceive to be increasing lack of respect for the profession. And they think that with the lack of respect comes more punitive policies that actually end up limiting their ability to be effective rather than helping students.
It's really interesting, given the sort of the macro look at how America feels about education would seem to imply that teachers picked up a lot of capital in recent years in, granted, states outside Michigan, places like Oklahoma and West Virginia, where the public, teachers chose to protest and the public really came out in force and said, yes, we support this. We support paying our teachers and making sure our schools aren't completely falling apart. And yet, do you think that that's a separate issue than some of the trends that you've been able to research in Michigan?
Yeah, so we certainly find that in the conversations that we have, that there's a lot of support for local teachers. People always say our schools are wonderful. The teachers that I know are wonderful. But as you mentioned, there does seem to be some sort of disconnect between, you know, talking to people one-on-one about their local educators and the policies that we are seeing play out. In Michigan, for example, the average teacher's salary is higher than the average income in Michigan, but it takes about 10 or so years to get to that level. The entry level salary for a teacher is much lower, and a lot of teachers leave the profession before they hit that point.
There's a policy discussion that would have to be had about shifting the equation and paying new teachers more. Was there any discussion within the forums of how that might work on a practical level?
That is certainly something that Dr. Nikolai Vidi of Detroit Public Schools touched on at our summit last November. He led a pay increase for a lot of teachers in Detroit Public Schools to solve their reliance on long-term substitute teachers. He says that they increased salaries by $9,000 on average for certain teachers, and they also offered signing bonuses for hard-to-staff schools. They found that that was a really effective way to fill a lot of the vacancies that they had, but they did see that that led a talent migration from a lot of charters in that area, which exacerbated this long-term sub issue at those charters. So it does seem that increasing salaries can be effective, but can sort of shift the problem around a little bit, so that if that is a solution that is pursued going forward, it would be important to note that.
I'm curious, were there any subs at the forum?
So we did have Dr. Robert Kimball. He is GVSU's Associate Vice President for Charter Schools. He is not a long-term sub, but they are the authorizer of a lot of charter schools that across the state that do rely very heavily on long-term subs. He said that this is an issue that they are concerned about, and they want to help be a part of the solution of getting more certified teachers in classrooms across the state.
As the next stage of solutions might ramp up after this, what are the policy issues that need to be addressed next? I mean, is there an obvious stakeholder to pick up the ball?
I think in terms of who is going to have to pick up the ball would depend on which policy option that people are hoping to pursue. When it comes to, say, encouraging undergraduates to enroll in teacher preparation programs, that would be a solution that would fall more toward our universities across the state. If it were to be reforming state law so retired teachers can substitute teach without diminished benefits, that would fall in the lap of the legislature. I guess what I think is really important to note here is that there is really resounding agreement across all of the demographics that we spoke to that this is an issue and that people want to see solutions. It is very rare ever, but especially these days, to find something, especially in education, where you see really broad consensus. And this is an issue that we saw broad consensus on.
Alexandra, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Alexandra Schmidt is Public Engagement Director and a reporter at Bridge Magazine. For a little bit more context, let's bring in Chris Wigan. He heads the Michigan Association of Superintendents. Chris, welcome back to Stateside.
Yeah, thank you very much. Always good to talk with you.
And as we've just heard, it appears that there's a strong mandate, according to Bridge's survey and research, to reduce our school district's reliance on long-term subs. Maybe it's a good idea to just talk about some of the reasons districts have had to rely on long-term subs in the first place.
Well, this is a really complicated, bigger picture issue, and it's a story and a whole hour-long discussion in total. However, I want listeners to know and others that, you know, school districts only use long-term subs as a very last resort. We certainly appreciate the service of long-term subs and what they bring to our school districts, but all of us would prefer to have regular certified teachers in front of the students for the entire year. However, we're at a point where we do have a definite teacher shortage, and we have to make sure that, you know, if there's not a full-time teacher available, we get the most prepared and the most ready long-term substitute that's possible. Not our preference, but we're kind of forced into this right now.
At the time when state rules were adjusted to allow for more use of long-term subs, people who only had 60 college credits under their belts, the Michigan Department of Education called those waivers a necessity. Would you say the conditions that led us down that road in terms of a teacher shortage have changed substantially?
You know, I think every year we continue to see with our members, with superintendents, a continued increase in the teacher shortage. I appreciate that the department lowered the amount of hours. It still is a local district decision. And so there are some districts that don't need to depend as much on that. They can keep the standard higher if they want. Or there are other districts that are really in trouble and need to reach out and adjust those hours. So it still is a local district decision, but one that allows some flexibility at the district level.
What are some creative solutions that districts in the association have tried, maybe places like Detroit, to try to get teachers in sooner and reduce their own reliance on long-term subs?
Well, there are certainly a lot of things that a lot of districts have tried. The 313 initiative in the Detroit area certainly is a great opportunity to bring teachers into the profession and keep them into the profession. But we all need to do some things together, and we're working with the labor unions, we're working with Department of Education, post-secondary institutions, and we've done some polling of teachers, and we found out that areas we need to improve upon, we need to change the perception of public education in the eyes of our legislators and also our communities, and turn things around so that we would tell our sons, our daughters, our friends, you should become a teacher. It's a great profession. We need to make sure that the compensation is fair and appropriate. And in many districts, we aren't able to be there yet. We also need to make sure that we lower the amount of bureaucratic things that a teacher has to do so they can focus on the children. And we also need to continue to make sure that things like teacher evaluations and other professional development activities are relevant and meaningful. So this wasn't created overnight. It's not going to be fixed overnight. But we all need to continue to work on this together. And that means everyone from top to bottom and side to side. It's a major issue in our state.
I mean, it sounds as if a big piece of this would be tipping the balance for financially, making it possible to start teachers at better base pay. What do you imagine might pave the way for that?
Well, I think we have to have a serious talk at the legislative level with policymakers, with those of us in education about really what that looks like and what amount of money are we talking about and how can we work to make that happen. School districts have been strapped for years. We all know that. They pay teachers as much as they can. You know, for many districts, approximately 85% of their budget is salaries and benefits. And so that's a huge amount. And we just can't increase that amount without additional dollars for education. And it's a policy discussion in the state. We've started it with the School Finance Research Collaborative and some of the weighted funding that's necessary. But it's a serious discussion we have to have. And I will also say that we know it's not just about the compensation. There are many other factors that have created this shortage. But certainly the compensation is a big one that has to be addressed while we work on the others.
Do you think it makes a difference to inform parents about the training that their kid's teacher might have? One of the things that came up in the Bridge survey was suggesting that if parents simply knew who was in the classroom, they might be ready to take on some of that advocacy themselves and say, this is not acceptable.
Yeah, I think that's a fair and reasonable request, and we need to figure out how to do that so that it doesn't burden school building staff that's already overburdened with all types of things that they have to do. But yes, we certainly support parents knowing who is in front of their child, and that should be worked out at the local level. And we certainly appreciate any parent involvement in their child's education, and if being more communicative on the teacher that's in front of them helps with that, we certainly need to work in that direction.
Is alternative certification an answer?
Well, I don't know. I think it depends. You know, part of this is trying to make sure that we have teachers in front of children without lowering the standards for quality. And that's a fine line. So I think we need to do more looking at alternative education certification. I think we need to examine all aspects of teacher certification at this point. So I would suggest that we take a careful look at that, but at the same time, make sure that the alternative certification meets the ethical and legal requirements to make sure we have a quality teacher in front of the students.
It feels like the way that the state got into this situation was by acknowledging that kids need caring adults in the classroom, and that maybe our path to finding those caring adults, you know, doesn't have to always look the same as finding a full-time teacher. But is there really a way around finding a certified teacher for every classroom?
Well, right now, that's just not possible. We ran a survey in September after school had been in session for 2 weeks, And 60% of the superintendents who responded to the survey still had one or more teacher opening in their classrooms. So at this point, we just don't see the match of the amount of certified teachers and the amount that we need in the profession. So it remains a serious problem. And, you know, I have a lot of empathy for school districts. They want to put the highest quality, most certified teacher in front of their children. But if you don't have applicants, or the applicants you have just don't meet your quality standards, then I understand the need for long-term subs.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
All right. Thank you very much.
Chris Wigan is the executive director of the Michigan Association of Superintendents. We get it. Life gets busy. You're rushing from home to work, maybe a stop at the kids' school in between, home again. You can't always catch Stateside here on your radio at 3 p.m. That does not mean you have to miss out on our conversations with the people who shape our state. Just subscribe to the Stateside podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Coming up, we hear from Congressman Andy Levin on the way forward for regulating and disposing of PFAS. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel announced that the state is suing 17 companies that manufacture PFAS for various products. The suit claims that the companies knew of the risks to human health and did not alert the public to the dangers. PFAS has been detected in drinking water at many sites in Michigan and has been linked to myriad health problems, damage to internal organs, and some forms of cancer. Lawmakers from Michigan have been sounding the alarm in Washington, D.C. as well. Last week, the House passed a bill to regulate PFAS and disposal of those harmful chemicals. Congressman Andy Levin is in the group of lawmakers working on the issue, and he joins us now. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you so much, and welcome to you, April.
Thank
Stateside
you.
Is a major institution in our state, so it's really great to have you there.
It is great to be here. Before we talk about the bill, the state of Michigan filed suit against 3M and DuPont and other companies, 17 defendants total, claiming that they deliberately concealed the dangers of PFAS chemicals, going for substantial damages. Is that an appropriate step?
It sure is. I mean, we have really gotten away from holding polluters accountable in this country. We need these major corporations that knowingly profit from selling chemicals that are poisonous, that are carcinogenic, that cause cancer, that cause reproductive problems, on and on. We need to hold them accountable for cleaning it up. And so that's what the Attorney General and the Governor are trying to do there, and I'm right with them.
We've heard so much about PFAS in our water systems and the state's contaminated sites. As we look at the bill that you've put forward, what is the risk posed by PFAS in the air?
Well, so we've got to get PFAS out of the ground, out of the water. But if we then incinerate it and we just put PFAS into the air, then we're going to breathe it in. And as your listeners have probably heard, PFAS is a forever chemical. 98% of Americans already have PFAS in us. And one of the most effective ways of transmitting it is to breathe it in. So we really need to be very careful how we dispose of PFAS once we, move to remediation, which we've got to do much more quickly than the EPA is doing.
Right. And your bill pertains to how PFAS chemicals are disposed of by incineration. Just to be clear, we're talking about Department of Defense contractors incinerating specially made firefighting foam that was made with PFAS chemicals, right?
Well, so there's two things that I've done. The first bill was actually incorporated into the National Defense Authorization Act, which passed in December and was signed by the president. And that my provision in there specifically pertains to the Department of Defense. And it's not just about about incineration, actually. That bill covers how they store it, that they have to store it in a way that meets Clean Water Act standards, and so there isn't leakage of PFAS contaminated water into the groundwater or the drinking water systems. And then it also covers disposal through incineration. And now the PFAS Safe Disposal Act that was put into the broader PFAS Action Act, which we just passed, is about incineration particularly, and it goes beyond the Department of Defense. It calls on the EPA to make sure that countrywide, system-wide, we make sure that PFAS is disposed of in a way that doesn't make the problem worse by releasing it into the air.
The law, as you say, already requires that incineration be overseen and conducted within controlled temperatures that are designed to break down PFAS chemicals. Why is that standard inadequate?
Well, so the EPA has failed to act on PFAS. That's why we called it the PFAS Action Act. We need them to set safe standards, and we need them to really oversee the disposal of PFAS. You could have companies disposing of PFAS by themselves and violating those standards, and the EPA doesn't even get involved. I mean, I just think that we've got something that is in danger of becoming sort of the DDT of our era, a whole big family of chemicals. There are literally thousands of different compounds. They were made not just for firefighting foam, but for nonstick pans and water repellent clothing and so forth. And we need to investigate all of this and make sure that we identify all of its uses and dispose and get it out of these industrial processes. And so we need EPA to step up and be much more aggressive about this, just like we need the Defense Department to be careful about all of its facilities.
The bill says that when PFAS chemicals are incinerated, the EPA needs to make sure they don't become dispersed in the air. So are you saying that incinerators need to have scrubbers installed?
There's the technology is sort of nascent on this, really, and there are different possible avenues. There's the question of temperatures and whether incineration at very high temperatures could prevent them from being released. And then there's the question of scrubbers and other filtering devices that could keep PFAS out of the air. The whole problem here, I mean, I think the first step is humility. Our country does not say that a company has to prove a chemical safe before they start using it in industry, like happens mostly in Europe. So now we have to play catch up, and we have to say, what are these different compounds? What does safe incineration mean in the PFAS context? And so we need to get going with research on what the best disposal methods are. And in the meantime, we have to make sure that disposal that happens doesn't just exacerbate the problem.
Is the goal to come up with other options beyond incineration?
That is also a real live question. Are there ways of treating water that could remove PFAS? We don't have any of those methods in existence yet, but we should be aggressively looking. I mean, that's, really the great thing about America, that I feel like this in this whole Trump era, we are not taking scientific approaches. Just how proud are most of us as Americans, how patriotic about the incredible innovation and creativity and research that we have, demonstrated over a couple hundred years now in solving technological problems. If the EPA takes a stance that we're going to defend big corporations and we're going to bury our head in the sand and not get about doing this, you're stopping all this research that needs to happen. And it is so penny wise and pound foolish, because look at, people can't fish in the Huron River. I mean, and as we do more, investigations, we may find that more and more of our water systems are contaminated. More and more of our rivers need to be restricted. So we need to take an aggressive scientific approach to this and not bury our head in the sand, which is seems like what EPA is doing now. And you know, those of us in Congress from Michigan, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, different states where this problem is manifesting more, Republicans as well as Democrats are uniting around this approach. So, you know, we had quite a few Republicans who voted for this. I think there were 24 who voted for this bill. So, you know, in this day and age, that's pretty bipartisan. And it's a real beachhead of Republicans working with Democrats to solve this problem.
There are some different concerns when it comes to firefighting and the firefighting that takes place on Air Force bases. I wonder, tell us if you think, how do you think the Department of Defense is doing addressing this problem? Do you feel like it's turning its head away from the issue, or has it been an acceptable partner?
Well, I think the DOD, I think they should have moved faster, and I think they should have been more aggressive about this. But I really want to put responsibility on the doorstep of elected officials. The President of the United States is the Commander-in-Chief. We are, the Congress makes the laws and, organizes the military, decides what equipment to give them, funds all their, you know, the troops and the bases. We need to say to DOD, this is the deal. This is what you have to do. If you want to blame the DOD, I think they deserve their fair share of blame. But look, every fire department has been used. Every local fire department in the 9th District and, you know, Oakland and Macomb County and everywhere else has used this stuff. It worked great. And, you know, it's a hard thing to put out fires that, especially if it involves a lot of jet fuel or diesel fuel or other things. So, you know, we learn as we go. Look at how we dealt with refrigeration. You know, when we found out that the chemicals we were using caused a big problem for the ozone layer, people said, oh my gosh, that's going to be impossible, you know, to replace. And actually, we came up with innovation and, your refrigerator still works pretty well. So I think we could do the same thing with PFAS, but, you know, industry will get about it when we tell them the gig is up. You've got to come up with other compounds that work well here. And we're not going to let you keep selling something and using something that is such a grave danger to human health.
Do we know how much contaminated foam and water may still be out there? My understanding is that the Air Force may have already incinerated much of its stockpile.
We don't know. We don't know how much is out there. And we don't know. In general, what happened was that our military bases, because they have a lot of difficult potential fire situations with fighter jets and tanks and so forth, and if there were crashes or you know, problems, fires based with the fuels that we use there, they did a lot of drills, and they used PFAS to, you know, practice. I think they mostly just washed it off the runway or the pad or wherever they were into the ground. They simply didn't, you know, it wasn't dealt with properly at all for many years. So we need to, you know, they've got to test around all the bases. We've got to test around all the places where this may have been used. It's going to take some time. We're going to have to build it into our practice, and we're going to, you know, we have a ways to go before we find out the extent of this problem.
A listener named Kelly left a comment on our Facebook page. She writes, the federal government has an obligation to clean these chemicals, which are causing irreparable harm in our communities, period. End of quote. She would seem to agree with your assessment that the federal government really needs to step up and do the enforcement on this. At the same time, the PFAS Action Act passed in the House. It's stranded in the Senate, and the White House has suggested it will be vetoed if it moves forward. What are your goalposts on this? Do you feel like you maybe can get a few things codified, and those are the ends that you want to go for right now?
Well, you know, I take the same approach to this as I do to other important areas of legislation. I mean, we've passed over 400 bills we passed in 2019 through the House. 275 of them were bipartisan, and virtually none of them have been moved by the Senate. And the president threatens to veto this and that. He actually, I mean, for example, we passed through both houses a bill to say stop supporting Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen that is causing famine, that is causing children to die, people to be dislocated. And the president vetoed that. And we simply did not have the supermajorities in the House and Senate to overcome the president's vetoes. My approach is to pass through the House legislation that reflects the policy that the American people deserve. And I don't expect Mitch McConnell to just vote on everything we pass. Let him pass a bill through PFAS, through the Senate on PFAS that he thinks is a different approach, and we can go to conference and hammer out a compromise. I'm all about the sausage making. They're just not making any sausage at all over there. They're refusing to do their jobs besides passing right-wing judges. That was the one thing they've been working on. And I'm fine with filling vacancies in the judiciary, but the Senate has to do its job. I think that this is the way our democracy works, April. We're going to have an election here for every member of the House, for many senators, and for the president in less than 10 months. And I think all we can do in the House is our part of the work, which is pass bills that should become law. You know, we've passed a Raise the Wage Act to have $15 an hour be a minimum throughout the country by 2025. We passed legislation to say that Medicare should negotiate the price of prescription drugs, to put a ceiling on out-of-pocket costs for our seniors on prescription drugs. We've passed sensible background check bills, two bills, one to make background checks universal and one to make sure that they work well by giving the authorities enough time to get back to gun dealers about whether someone should be sold a gun or not. We've passed so much legislation, and I'm all about the Senate. It's controlled by the Republicans. That's fine. They can take a different approach. But what the heck? Pass something on these matters, and let's negotiate whatever way we can move the ball forward. Your listener is absolutely right. The federal government should be doing this work to protect the American people from PFAS contamination and its health effects. And all I can do is, keep passing legislation in the House and call on our colleagues in the Senate to get to work on it.
Congressman Levin, thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you, April. It's so great to talk to you, and good luck in these first months.
Thank you.
You sound great.
Thanks. Congressman Andy Levin represents Michigan's 9th District. Earlier this week, Stateside's Laura Weber Davis added the word Michigander to one of my scripts. Look, as a 30-year Ohioan and 16-year Oregonian, I just find that word odd. And the proposed alternative, Michiganian? That's weird too. I'm sorry, it just is. But I am so far from the definitive opinion on this, so we went to Twitter with the question, how should residents of Michigan identify themselves? Caitlin in East Lansing writes, sorry, April, it's Michigander, although she notes Michigangster is also acceptable. A listener named Sean pointed out, I grew up with Michigander. It makes sense enough as an English extension of an already Native American-derived name. Sean suggests we probably should have just learned the native languages, and then we wouldn't have this problem of sounding silly. Fair point. But I gotta say that Robin Milford gets the win today. He writes, Michiganians drink Schweppes and call clubs when you have both red bowers and a handful of hearts. Be wary. Whew. Sick burns. The poll is still up on Twitter. We have more than 650 votes and counting as of right now, and it is a blowout in favor of Michigander. Laura, if you're listening, drinks are on me this week. But there's still time for you to vote. We're at Stateside Radio. I'm at April Bear if you wish to add some comments or throw food, but the show's handle is at Stateside Radio. That's our show for this week. I'm April Bear. Thanks for listening.